that you're on the best dosages for you.
13. Hormonal changes. A major hormonal shift, such as that of puberty, pregnancy, or childbirth, can feed the thyroid virus with one of its favorite food sources, hormones. An abundance of these hormones flooding the bloodstream can give the thyroid virus the fuel it craves to thrive. During the height of a hormonal shift, the immune system can become compromised as well, and that offers the thyroid virus an advantage. This trigger is why many adolescents and new mums find themselves suddenly sick. 14. Recreational drug abuse. Illegal drugs that contain toxins can both throw off your immune system and provide fuel for a thyroid virus infection. 15. Financial strain. When life has you worried about losing your home or job, not being able to pay the bills, or needing to take on extra work to cover unexpected expenses, the negative emotions can be overwhelming. Fear of failure, fear of dying, loss of self-image, and shame can all be wrapped up in these experiences, and they can weaken your immune system's ability to fend off infection of the thyroid virus. 16. Physical injuries. A twisted ankle, broken leg, car accident, or other physical injury or trauma can wear down your body to a point where the thyroid virus sees an opportunity to come out of dormancy and make the move to infection. If you require an operation, the virus sees even more of an opportunity because the surgery is usually accompanied by antibiotics. 17. Professional carpet cleaning. Many traditional carpets contain toxins, plus carpet cleaning solutions contain synthetic chemicals that are highly toxic for you. So the carpet cleaning process adds poisons on top of poisons. Breathing these fumes for hours each day can weaken your immune system and can also awaken and feed the thyroid virus. If you're very sensitive, consider removing your carpets, otherwise opt for green carpets, organic cleaning solutions, and or a modern green carpet cleaning service. 18. Fresh paint. Most fresh paint fills the air with toxic fumes. If you spend time in a newly painted home or office without good circulation, the toxins can end up weakening your immune system and triggering the thyroid virus. Always select no or low VOC paints. VOC stands for volatile organic compounds. And even then, circulate plenty of fresh air before you spend an extended period of time indoors. 19. Summer swimming. The red algae that can accumulate in lakes or along the ocean shore in warm weather creates a loss of oxygen that encourages the growth of bacteria, which can weaken your immune system and trigger the thyroid virus to come out of dormancy. If you're planning to go swimming, keep your eye out for warnings of red tide. 20. Runoff. The runoff from old land dumps and other toxic sources can contain heavy metals and other harmful substances that flow into nearby lakes, especially during hot summer weather. Swimming in these contaminated lakes exposes you to the toxins and lowers your immune system's ability to fight off the thyroid virus. 21. Insomnia. Any prolonged sleep issue will disrupt your body, which can, over time, give the thyroid virus the opportunity to spring to life. Viral issues can also be the cause of sleep disturbances in the first place. For much more on what's behind insomnia and how to leave it behind, see Part 4, Secrets of Sleep. 22. Insect bites and stings. A spider bite, bee sting, tick bite or the like occasionally leaves behind venom or a piece of the insect in your skin that can get infected. This infection can in turn weaken your immune system, and if you have an underlying presence of the thyroid virus and the timing is perfect, The thyroid virus can use the opportunity to take hold in your system. The truth about triggers. I hope that the simple act of hearing this list has given you some insight into your particular circumstances. When you understand the why of your illness, it is a revelation that sets you on the true path to healing. When you eliminate that mystery about why sickness visited you at this time in your life, it puts the power back in your hands. If you've been on the doctor shopping tour or read a lot about thyroid health, you might have learned already that experts suspect some of these factors are involved in thyroid illness. You might even have heard that some of the triggers you just read about are at the very root of thyroid illness. Let me be perfectly clear that these triggers are not to be mistaken for causes of thyroid virus symptoms. No matter what you've heard elsewhere, no matter which trigger, it is not the underlying reason you are sick. Further, these triggers do not put the blame on you. They don't make it so that somehow your sickness is your fault or the fault of the life you lead. A trigger is only a trigger. One more time. A trigger is only a trigger. In order for it to give fuel to the thyroid virus, the virus has to be there in your system in the first place. More on how easy it is to catch the virus in the next chapter. Put it this way. The thyroid virus is like a fire. A thyroid virus trigger is simply gasoline thrown on the flames that makes them get hotter and spread faster. This is why a husband and wife can both be exposed to mold, living, breathing, and even eating in the same house every day, and the husband can be perfectly fine while the wife is bedridden from it, leaving both mold experts and health experts baffled. In that example, the wife has the thyroid virus in her system, and the mold is triggering it, while the husband is virus-free. Or you could have a family of five exposed to mold on a daily basis, and only three family members come down with illness. Those three are the ones with the thyroid virus in their systems, and the mold has triggered the virus to become active and cause health problems. If everyone in the family gets sick, on the other hand, that's a sign that everyone has the thyroid virus. It's true that there are some varieties of mold so toxic that no one exposed to it will feel perfect. If one person or more exposed to this toxic mold in the home, office, car, or other source gets sicker than the rest, though, that usually indicates that this individual has the thyroid virus and the mold wore down her or his immune system so the virus could take advantage. While the virus I'm calling the thyroid virus sometimes comes up in medical discussions of thyroid problems, this incredibly common pathogen is not identified by medical communities as the thyroid virus. The virus is still considered secondary to thyroid illness. No one realizes the virus goes after the thyroid and causes all of the disruption there. Rather, observers have noticed that some people with thyroid issues also test positive for having been infected with the virus, and so they've made note that the two may be vaguely associated. Sometimes theorists guess that the virus is a trigger to autoimmune responses, which is not the case at all. You are the expert on the real triggers now. While in many ways it can be liberating to look at the trigger list, I understand that it may also feel overwhelming. After all, you can't control whether someone will break your heart or betray you. You can't make your loved ones live forever. You can't prevent all of life's injuries and accidents. Does that mean you're doomed to get sick every time one of these events crops up in your life? Absolutely not. I don't want you to look at this list and feel afraid of life. Because here's the truth. We have a fundamental, God-given right to go through hardships unscathed. We're allowed to experience events that challenge us. We're supposed to go through these challenges and they're not meant to bring us down. You have a fundamental right not to fear triggers. You are meant to have the freedom to experience life without illness. So how do you move forward with this new knowledge? You use the information in the trigger list to heighten your awareness so that you can protect yourself and your family from these triggers that are avoidable. And then you take the measures you'll read about throughout this book to tame the thyroid virus, build up your immune system, and revive your thyroid. To take care of yourself the way you've always deserved, so that you're in prime shape to face all that life has in store for you. Chapter 3. How the Thyroid Virus Works. Just how easy is it to catch the thyroid virus in the first place? Very. You could have picked it up from sharing a beer with a friend in college, from a kiss when dating, from eating out at a restaurant where an infected cook had a cut finger, from a blood transfusion, from sharing group bathrooms, from being sneezed on in elementary school. Or you even could have gotten the virus at conception from your parents, because it's not uncommon for this virus to pass down through family lines. While many of the early, crude varieties of the thyroid virus were more difficult to catch and generally only transmitted through blood and occasionally saliva, the newer mutations of the thyroid virus, there are over 60 strains of it so far, are as easy to catch as cold or flu. Blood, saliva, tears, a runny nose and more, intentional or unintentional exposure to these bodily fluids of someone who was in a contagious phase of the virus, are all means of catching it. The virus is only a sneeze or a sip from a shared glass away. And it is entirely possible that you could have picked it up without realizing at the time. Because in its early stages, the thyroid virus often doesn't cause any more symptoms than a brief and mild scratchy throat with some tiredness. Maybe there was a week or two, whether you were a child, teenager or adult, or even when you were a baby, when you were feeling run down for no identifiable reason, and then it passed. It could have seemed so unremarkable that you or your family didn't really register it, so the memory didn't stick. Or maybe the virus made itself more than known after its incubation period, putting you through a month or more of extreme fatigue, feverishness, sore throat, headaches, swollen glands, and even rash. A memorable time of prolonged illness that eventually seemed to run its course. In truth, even after any initial symptoms faded, the virus was making itself more and more at home in your body, moving along and building its numbers until one day, perhaps weeks or perhaps decades later, after the right triggers and circumstances converged, the virus could advance all the way to the thyroid, its best platform to get strong enough to inflame or go after your central nervous system. What is the thyroid virus? Some of the above information may sound familiar. A virus that's easy to pick up in college when sharing drinks and dorms, that's associated with kissing, and can give a person fatigue, fever, and sore throat for months. Does it sound like mono, aka glandular fever or the kissing disease? That's because it is. That's right. The pathogen that I've been calling the thyroid virus is the same one that causes mononucleosis. Epstein-Barr virus, EBV. Medical communities have yet to discover that mono is only stage 2 of this virus, that in fact, the virus has 4 stages, the third of which targets the thyroid gland, explaining over 95% of thyroid problems. The other 5% of thyroid problems come from radiation exposure due to chest, dental and other x-rays, CT scans, food and water supply contamination, plane travel, cell phones, inheritance of our parents' and grandparents' exposure, and the continuous atmospheric radiation fallout from past nuclear disasters. Epstein-Barr virus types. Epstein-Barr is a virus in the herpes family that has existed for well over 100 years. During that time, it has moved through many generations of people, mutating and elevating its various hybrids and strains along the way. Those strains, as I said earlier, there are over 60 of them, can be categorized into 6 groups of escalating severity, with roughly 10 types per group. Medical research and science have so far only found strains of the virus in one of those groups. When Anthony Epstein, Yvonne Barr, and Bert Achong reported their discovery of EBV in 1964, they had most likely found what I call Epstein-Barr virus numbers 6 and 7 from group 2. This is not to be confused with the medical establishment's human herpes virus numbering, which calls Epstein-Barr HHV4. That term is merely the identification of the virus as a whole. Soon after the landmark discovery of EBV, funding for further research was shut down, and that was all, folks. All these decades later, medical communities are as yet unaware that so many different groups and mutated strains of the virus exist. Some strains of EBV, those in group 1, are very mild and slow-moving. They may never result in anything more than a backache and may never progress as far as the thyroid. Other strains of EBV are more aggressive and fast-moving. They're responsible for some of the most debilitating illnesses of our time, including multiple sclerosis and various cancers. If you want to learn more about these EBV groups, I discuss them in more detail in the chapter Epstein-Barr Virus, Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, and Fibromyalgia of my first book, Medical Medium. These various types of EBV explain why the virus presents so differently in different people. They also explain the wide range of thyroid issues out there. Goiters, for example, develop as a result of the first viral strain in group 1. Hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease, on the other hand, are caused specifically by those varieties of EBV in groups 4 and 5. These are aggressive strains that prompt the thyroid to produce extra thyroid tissue in self-defense, in turn causing the overproduction of thyroid hormones. EBV strains in groups 4 and 5 also account for thyroid cancer. More on how thyroid cancer develops in Chapter 6, Thyroid Cancer. Benign tumors, nodules, and cysts, meanwhile, can be caused by EBV varieties from groups 2 through 6. And Hashimoto's thyroiditis and hypothyroidism can be caused by any strain of EBV in any group. Epstein-Barr virus is spreading at such an epidemic level right now that in 20 years there will be close to 100 varieties, with most of the new ones hitting youth. It's bad enough that already roughly 17 out of 100 college students do not return to school after their first or second year due to the health effects of newer mutations of EBV. They're left back at home, lost and struggling with the virus's debilitating symptoms, many of them receiving Lyme disease diagnoses, which we'll cover later in this book. With no real answers about what's going on, these students despair as they try to figure out how they'll ever support themselves or live the lives they imagined. Now think about how many more children and young adults will be sidelined in 2 decades' time, with the virus's mutations progressing as they are. It's why, more than ever before, this is a virus that needs our attention. It's why it's time for you to become an expert by reading this book. Knowing how the thyroid virus works is the only way to protect yourself and your loved ones from all the problems it has the potential to cause. Viral poisons. As you hear about EBV's stages in the next section, there are a few terms that will be helpful to know. These are toxic cast-offs that the virus creates as it replicates, and they usually cause problems in stage 3 when the virus targets the thyroid, and stage 4 when it goes after the central nervous system. They are a big part of what makes EBV so troublesome. Viral byproduct. As EBV consumes its favorite foods, which include toxic heavy metals, excess adrenaline, and even eggs, if they're in your diet, it excretes this toxic waste matter. The more virus cells develop, the more byproduct is excreted, and the more problems it causes, such as gumming up the mitral valve and creating heart palpitations. Viral corpses. Virus cells have a roughly 6-week life cycle, which means that the cells are often dying off. These viral corpse cells are toxic too, and as EBV grows in the body, there are more and more of them. You can think of viral corpses almost like dead crabs washed up on the beach with shells, viral casings, that are either empty or still have some rotting meat inside. Because EBV cells shapeshift, these corpses end up with different shapes as well. Viral corpse accumulation in the liver and lymphatic system creates sluggishness that often contributes to issues such as fatigue, weight gain, fluid retention, constipation, bloating, hot flashes, heart flutters, brain fog, and perimenopause or menopause symptoms. When someone has a lot of EBV activity in the body, the viral corpses eventually make it to the intestinal tract. If someone has a stool sample taken in this state, the hundreds or even thousands of viral corpses in the sample often confuse lab technicians and doctors who mistakenly diagnose parasitical activity. Neurotoxins. In the later stages of the virus, EBV produces neurotoxins, poisons that disrupt nerve function. These neurotoxins come out as part of the virus's filmy byproduct sludge, then disperse, often inflaming the nerves and causing a great deal of pain. Neurotoxins also reside in the viral corpses, if there's leftover meat inside their casings, and the neurotoxins can seep out as the corpses drift through the body. These EBV excretions are made up of whatever the virus is feeding off of, such as mercury and other toxic heavy metals. And when these fuels come out the other end of the virus, they're even more corrupted versions of themselves. More disruptive and allergenic, almost like the venom of a poisonous spider or snake. EBV remanufactures these other toxins so that they become extra potent in their new form as viral neurotoxins, with a strength that can damage and kill off healthy cells in the organs and connective tissue. If the virus happens to consume excreted neurotoxins that it finds along the way, the toxic materials are remanufactured again, and the potency of the poison is increased once more, able to do even more damage to cells as well as to irritate and inflame nerves with more intensity. EBV uses these poisons at strategic periods in stage 3 and continuously in stage 4 to prevent the immune system from zeroing in on the virus cells and attacking them. Dermatoxins. Similar to neurotoxins, these poisons are excreted by EBV when copper and pesticides, such as DDT from generations past, are sitting in the liver, giving a specific type of fuel to the virus. As with neurotoxins, dermatoxins can also remain in viral corpses and seep out over time. Because EBV tends to make the liver and lymphatic system sluggish and dysfunctional, they usually have trouble filtering out these poisons, so the toxins tend to escape through the skin, causing irritation, pain, itching, and/or rashes. These internal dermatoxins are much different from the known versions of dermatoxins, which are harmful chemicals that cause damage to the skin from the outside. EBV dermatoxins come from within, drifting up through the dermis, and they can result in someone receiving a diagnosis of eczema, psoriasis, or psoriatic arthritis. Because copper and DDT, like other toxins, can be passed down through generations, even the livers of newborns can contain them, which is how babies develop cases of eczema, psoriasis and jaundice that baffle medical communities. Epstein-Barr virus stages. As I said, EBV has four stages, and thyroid illness is what develops in stage three. Understanding all of the stages in more detail can help you better understand what you've been through and what you want to prevent. Stage one, the baby stage. When a person first catches EBV, or when someone is born with it, the virus is in the bloodstream and it usually remains dormant. If you have EBV, then back at this early stage, it probably wouldn't have seemed like you were sick. The worst symptoms you might have experienced were listlessness, very mild fatigue, and a bit more susceptibility to colds, flus, sore throats, and earaches. For some people with mild cases of EBV or those with robust immune systems, the virus will remain at this baby stage, dormant in the bloodstream and causing little to no discomfort for the rest of their lives. For those who've contracted more forceful strains of EBV that eventually cause thyroid problems and more, this is just the beginning. In these cases, the virus is quietly replicating in the blood, building its numbers for days, weeks, months, or many years, waiting for the right circumstances and the right triggers so that it can develop into stage two, mononucleosis, followed by infection of organs such as the liver and spleen. Luckily, it doesn't have to be this way. It's not inevitable that once contracted, the Epstein-Barr virus will march along to the organs and more. Here, in stage one, the virus is still vulnerable. If you know you've been exposed to someone in the contagious mono phase, and you discover the antiviral measures in part three, thyroid resurrection, this is the point when it's easiest to get rid of most of the virus and keep in check any that remains. Stage 2. The war stage. EBV often springs to life and enters stage 2, which begins with mononucleosis, when someone has gotten particularly run down. That's why college is such a prime time for students who are up late partying and studying and whose diet may have taken a turn for the worse since leaving home, to find themselves coming down with mono. Out of all the illnesses that sweep through colleges and universities, there isn't any more prevalent or rampant than mononucleosis. In other words, early stage 2 Epstein-Barr virus. It's unknown that 70% of all college students get mono sometime within their 4 years of school. It's entirely possible to come down with mono before or after college too. If you're dealing with a thyroid problem now and have no recollection of ever having had mono, consider the possibility that you went through it as a small child. Though nowadays, doctors are starting to diagnose mono in children as young as 6, 7, or 8. Traditionally, doctors only gave the mono label to older children. For the most part, it has been against the rules to diagnose mono in a child younger than 6. Regardless of what blood tests show. This is a classic regulatory issue in the medical field that holds back progress. In babies and young children, mono is and was often instead called rheumatic fever or glandular fever, though it's really the same illness, stage 2 active EBV infection. Or you could have had mono as an adult, and if it was on the milder side, never realized what it was. Some people experience only a mild scratchy throat and some fatigue for a week. Then it passes and they never realize it was mono. This phase is the point when the virus is infectious. If you have EBV, and it wasn't passed down your family line, meaning you've had it since birth, then you caught it from someone in your daily life who knowingly or unknowingly had mononucleosis. When you eventually reached your own mono phase, it could have been difficult for a doctor to diagnose. Blood testing for this is not completely reliable. It really comes down to each individual doctor's interpretation of either the antibodies that show up in your blood or subtle inconsistencies that aren't taught in medical school regarding the blood's white count. It's entirely possible that you simply never got the right label. What's happening during mono is that your body's immune system is at war with the Epstein-Barr virus. At this point, instead of going stealth, as in stage one when it wasn't causing any trouble, now the EBV starts releasing a chemical that announces to your immune system that an invader is present. It's like blowing the battle horn. EBV's goal here is to take down your lymphatic system, because that's your body's defense mechanism. Your immune system responds by sending identifier cells to tag virus cells with a hormone that marks them as invaders in your blood and lymph. Then it sends soldier cells to seek out and kill the tagged virus cells. While this battle rages, a person experiences those mono symptoms from mild to severe, depending on which viral strain or variety a person has. These symptoms, such as sore throat, fever, headache, and rash, are not signs of your body rebelling against you. They're actually signs of the power of your immune system coming to your defense. Sometimes these symptoms come and go. That's because at certain points the immune system is able to get the virus under control, then it needs to gather its resources to fight the next battle. At a certain point, the virus will get the message that it can't stay active forever, so it will begin looking for a long-term home in the body. Eventually, after just a week of mono or several months of it, the virus will pick an organ or organs, and it will recede from the bloodstream as it begins to nest. The war with the virus will die down, and EBV will enter stage two's second phase, when typically the virus is dormant and in retreat, though still alive and alert, camping out and lying in wait for triggers. Unfortunately, this hiding out mode doesn't stop the virus from causing problems. For everyone with stage 2 EBV, unless they're on a thorough antiviral protocol like the one you'll find later in this book, the virus ends up in the liver during this nesting phase. Why the liver? Because the liver is a filter for the body, so toxins such as mercury, dioxins, unhealthy fats, poisons that were passed down from earlier generations, and other waste matter accumulate there, and these just happen to be some of EBV's favorite foods to consume in order to stay alive and regenerate. If you're trying to think back and understand how the virus might have affected you at this stage, ask yourself if there was any point at which you started to gain weight despite eating a healthy diet and exercising, or if there came a period when you started to feel more tired and listless than normal, possibly accompanied by a lack of motivation and a little brain fog. That's the likely time at which EBV got itself comfortable in the second phase of stage two. EBV and its toxic waste clog up the liver, making it sluggish, and a slowed-down, overloaded liver has everything to do with mysterious weight gain and changes in energy levels and mental clarity. More on these in Chapter 5. Your doctor or trainer wouldn't have been able to tell you that EBV in the liver was the cause of the number going up on the scale, because current EBV tests are designed to detect the virus's presence in the bloodstream, not the organs. Instead, your doctor is likely to blame your weight gain on perimenopause or hormones, or, if she or he keeps up with the latest theories, on your thyroid. Your trainer, meanwhile, might have blamed your weight gain on your exercise commitment or nighttime treats. Neither would have been right. It was never your fault. Once EBV has moved on to the organs, those blood tests will indicate a past infection of EBV, not a present one. Medical training teaches that this means the virus is no longer causing problems. No one realizes that the virus has simply gone deeper into the body at this point, out of full battle mode, though alive and well on other levels and in other ways. This misinterpretation of EBV blood testing is how the virus has slipped through the cracks, preventing medical communities from understanding the full scope of EBV's harm. With all due respect, it's one of the greatest medical blunders of both history and our modern time. What it will take for this to change is for more funding and research to go into interpreting lymphocyte, basophil, neutrophil and monocyte, and even blood platelet levels alongside EBV antibody levels, and to determine what the nuances of variations in these blood test results mean. Basically, an overhaul is needed in how professionals learn to read blood work. A past infection is probably very present and active somewhere in the body if these white blood cells show signs that they're putting up a fight. Is there something unusual going on with someone's lymphocytes, for example, while they also show past infection EBV antibodies? That's a good indication that EBV is at work in the organs and the reason for the patient's symptoms. Keep in mind that because blood work is still imperfect, as you'll hear about in Chapter 6, thyroid guess tests, it's common to be living with EBV and for blood test results not to show anything amiss. Other times, though, it's there in the blood work for medical professionals to unlock. Is EBV about to move from the liver to the thyroid? Is it in the thyroid already, creating a nodule or hypothyroidism? Is it on its way to causing another illness from Chapter 5? In many cases, the markers are there. Only when medical communities see this can they get ahead of the EBV epidemic. Other issues that can arise as a result of EBV nesting in the liver are an elevated A1C level, type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, hepatitis A, B, C and D, fibrosis, liver inflammation, development of sensitivities to foods that were never problematic before, and low hydrochloric acid in the stomach, the last of which translates to bloating, constipation, difficulty digesting food, and a toxic intestinal tract. This is often blamed on leaky gut syndrome, a misguided health theory that I talk about much more in Medical Medium. For some people, the virus will hang out solely in the liver at this point. For many others, the virus will simultaneously burrow into the spleen and or reproductive organs. EBV in the spleen, another filter for the body, will over time inflame the organ. The result is an enlarged spleen, splenomegaly, and spleen abnormalities that can give you a feeling of bloating or tenderness on your left side under your ribs. When EBV goes to a woman's reproductive organs, meanwhile, it can lead to fibroids, polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, and pregnancy complications. For men, one common target of EBV is the prostate, where the virus cells bury themselves and can, over a long period, result in cancer. That's right, EBV is the hidden cause of prostate cancer. This nesting period of stage 2 can last from roughly 1 month to 20 years. It depends on what strain of the virus someone has, from which group, as well as on living conditions and exposure to triggers. For many people, EBV stays low grade in the liver for decades and may not move on to the next stage until someone is about age 50, especially if it's a milder variety of the virus. For others, EBV can progress from mono to liver infection to the next stage, thyroid infection, in as little as 3 months. A very common scenario is for nesting to last 4 to 5 years. However long nesting lasts, the virus waits. Finally, when the right trigger or triggers come along, when someone goes through a time of profound grief or injury, for example, or an extra large dosage of new medication or anything else on the trigger list, the virus senses the excess stress hormones that go along with that immune system challenge. It identifies vulnerability and begins to take action, finally ready to make a break for its next target, the thyroid. Stage 3, the thyroid stage. At this point, some people will experience what feels like another mild bout of mono. This won't show up as mono on blood tests, because you've already had mono once before, so doctors will most likely notice the antibodies indicating past infection, and therefore determine that it can't be simultaneously active. Meanwhile, the virus does become very active again, filling the liver with toxins that release into the lymphatic system and bloodstream and confuse the lymphocytes that protect the thyroid. These are lymphocytes specifically assigned to the thyroid area and the tonsils if need be. Medical research and science have not yet discovered that your thyroid has its own individualized immune system and that these thyroid-specific lymphocytes are a major part of it. Over time, the virus will distract and wear down the overall immune system enough that the thyroid's own immune system is called to disperse to other parts of the body to help out, ultimately leading those special thyroid lymphocytes to leave the area of the thyroid. It's like the general's officers being drawn away from the campsite to go into battle, leaving the general exposed in his tent. With the thyroid's lymphocytes focused elsewhere, EBV cells can take advantage and get into the thyroid gland. Once the virus takes up residence in the thyroid, the mono symptoms will fade as the virus begins to burrow deep into thyroid tissue, causing the thyroid issues that are so often mistaken for aging, autoimmune, and menopause. These mature virus cells have actually shape-shifted at this point, allowing them to literally twist and spin like drills into the thyroid, killing off thyroid cells and scarring the gland as they go. As these drill-like virus cells die off and are replaced, their old viral casings enter the bloodstream, and because of their shape, these casings are very commonly mistaken in blood tests for spirochetes, such as Borrelia bacteria. Many people receive misdiagnoses of Lyme disease as a result. The deeper the virus hides in the thyroid, the harder it is for your immune system to tag the virus for destruction. Plus, EBV's neurotoxins, dermatoxins, viral byproduct, and poisonous corpses try to distract the immune system, giving it so much to handle at once that it can't put all its resources into stopping the active virus cells, especially if someone is eating what's known as a standard American diet or is dealing with any of the triggers from Chapter 2 at the same time. Stage 3 is when someone may also develop lupus due to the overabundance of neurotoxins, byproduct, and especially dermatoxins released at this time. I'll explain the condition in more detail in Chapter 5. Before we get into more thyroid details, keep in mind that some virus cells always stay behind, camping out in the liver, spleen, and/or reproductive system, even after much of the virus has moved on to colonize the thyroid. The leftover EBV cells continue to feed off of food sources they find in these organs, which means that long after it started to wreak thyroid havoc, the virus continues to contribute to organ issues such as a sluggish, stagnant or fatty liver, infertility, heart palpitations, digestive discomfort or brain fog. Plus, as the virus replicates in the thyroid, it throws off its byproduct, toxins and other waste, and since the liver and spleen are filters for these sorts of sludge, they become even more burdened in stage 3 than ever before. In some cases of thyroid illness, the viral attack of the thyroid gland remains mild, often because that person has a less aggressive strain of EBV, hasn't been exposed to many toxins in life, and doesn't encounter many triggers. If this is you, you may only experience mild hypothyroidism, which occurs as a result of the virus eating away at thyroid tissue, in turn lowering the amount of thyroid hormone that the gland can produce. Because this happens slowly over a period of years, hypothyroidism is often cast aside as a "you're getting older" diagnosis. As you'll hear about in the next two chapters, this hypothyroidism itself does not have a profound effect on your health because the body is well equipped to compensate for a shortage of thyroid hormones. In fact, millions of women have hidden hypothyroidism. They have no idea their thyroids are underactive, because this alone does not turn your life upside down. A hypothyroid is just one more symptom of EBV. Almost everyone with Epstein-Barr that reaches the thyroid experiences an underactive thyroid at some point. That's why this is one of the most widespread disorders on a global scale, and medical research and science aren't clued in about its real cause yet. In those cases where people experience many depleting symptoms alongside hypothyroidism, it's because inside the body, the virus is more active. Contrary to what the latest health sources say, most of the symptoms associated with hypothyroidism are unrelated to thyroid damage and are instead symptoms of EBV itself. Connecting to this truth can empower you greatly. Over time, and if the viral strain is more aggressive, the EBV may gain strength and steam, drilling into the thyroid with new intensity. This creates inflammation thyroiditis, accounting for the enlarged thyroids common in so many. As you'll hear about in part 2, The Great Mistakes in Your Way, inflammation is not a sign of the body going haywire, nor is it a cause or explanation of any illness. Inflammation is always a symptom of injury and or invasion by a foreign presence. Here in the thyroid, that inflammation occurs because of both factors: the destruction injury caused by the burrowing viral cells and the presence invasion of the virus itself. In response, the immune system creates antibodies to go after the EBV cells, antibodies that medical communities mistakenly say are produced by someone's own immune system to destroy thyroid tissue. That is so far from the truth. These antibodies do not destroy thyroid tissue. They destroy viral cells, the very thing that's causing the inflammation. These antibodies are the exact opposite of an indication that the immune system is malfunctioning and destroying the body. Rather, they are proof that your body is working beyond hard for you to protect you from this viral invader. Hashimoto's thyroiditis, then, is a more advanced version of hypothyroidism. While some sources will say it's the other way around, that Hashimoto's causes hypothyroidism, that's not the case. And what you have going on in your life, from other stresses on your immune system, to diet, to the triggers from Chapter 2, will determine how fast the virus may move from hypothyroidism, slight damage to an underperformance of the thyroid, to full-on Hashimoto's, a severely inflamed, more damaged thyroid. Childbirth is an especially common trigger for Hashimoto's, which is why you'll hear of many new mums developing the disease. Of course, your thyroid illness may go in the other direction, towards hyperthyroidism and or Graves' disease. As I mentioned earlier, these are caused by specific varieties of EBV that in stage 3 prompt the thyroid gland to produce more tissue and, as a result, more thyroid hormones. This has its own unique impact on health, which we'll look at later in this book. The important point to keep in mind for now is that once again, your body is on your side. It is the Epstein-Barr virus, the thyroid virus, causing these issues, not anything malfunctioning with your body or immune system. In all of these cases of stage 3 EBV, the virus can move on very shortly to its next target, or the battle can continue on in the thyroid for years on and off, depending on those factors we keep talking about, such as triggers, deficiencies, toxins, and the like. As in mono, here in stage 3, it's very common to experience symptom flare-ups followed by times of respite as the virus and your immune system continue their attempts to one-up each other. Symptoms you may experience at this stage include, though are not limited to, fatigue, brain fog, heart flutters, bloating, confusion, hot flashes, anxiety, sleeping issues, aches and pains, chronic sore throat, mild fever, tingles and numbness, thinning hair, brittle nails, dry skin, and dizziness. For a much more extensive list, along with explanations of each, refer to Chapter 5. These are all viral symptoms. Some of them symptoms of the virus still living back in another organ, not thyroid-caused. The immune system's priority during this ongoing battle is to protect the thyroid. If the virus has been in your thyroid for some time, then it's not uncommon for nodules, small lumps, to develop on the gland. These are calcium prisons the body creates to try to wall off the virus. Over time, if the trapped viral cells stay particularly active, the nodules can develop into cysts. Alternatively, sometimes small cysts develop on scar tissue in the thyroid. These can grow into benign tumors, and with those rare, aggressive varieties of EBV from groups 4 and 5, cancerous tumors can develop in the thyroid, which is usually an indication that someone also has high levels of toxins in her or his organs. The virus's aim in targeting the thyroid is to weaken your endocrine system. A compromised thyroid shifts the adrenals into overdrive, which can last for quite some time, and all that excess adrenaline is like a feast for the virus. EBV uses the adrenaline and cortisol to get bigger and stronger, and from this platform, it waits for just the right trigger, such as a heartbreak or divorce, or fuel, such as excess adrenaline, or one too many egg and cheese sandwiches, to advance to its ultimate goal, the central nervous system. Not that this is inevitable. All of this can be stopped, reversed, or controlled before it develops further. Stage 4. The mystery illness stage. As with the transition from stage 2 to stage 3, some virus cells stay behind, causing trouble at this point, even as the virus cells on the front lines cause new trouble ahead. In other words, as the virus begins to affect a person neurologically, it will usually continue to damage the thyroid plus burden the organs it targeted back in stage 2. Epstein-Barr can even move from stage 3 to stage 4 in as little as one day, meaning that it can begin to go after the thyroid and the central nervous system at almost the same time. Luckily, many people never reach this stage. With the information in this book, you can keep a case of stage 1, 2, or 3 EBV from reaching this most debilitating of stages. And if you have reached this stage, have no fear. You have the opportunity to get better. The battle can be won. As more mutations make their way into the population, many more people at younger and younger ages will get here to stage 4 if they don't have someone in their lives to share the truth revealed in these pages. So many people in their teens and early 20s are dealing with mystery symptoms such as fatigue, confusion, anxiety, depression, despondency, stomach aches, and racing thoughts. Sometimes these issues are ignored. Sometimes they're chalked up to adolescent angst, and sometimes they're tagged with labels such as attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, bipolar disorder, candida, or depersonalization. Prescriptions often accompany these diagnoses, though they often don't help because they're not addressing the true underlying viral issue. In a number of cases, young people are receiving misdiagnoses. What's really going on for so many of those who are suffering is stage 4 EBV getting underway. With a misdiagnosis of ADHD, for example, what may really be going on for a given person is viral-caused brain fog and confusion that make it difficult to focus, alternating with racing thoughts and restlessness from EBV's neurotoxins. It's not ADHD proper, which is mercury-caused. It's similar with misdiagnoses of bipolar disorder. Someone may actually be experiencing periods of flatlining neurological fatigue, a neurotoxin-induced depression, alternating with periods of intense activity that occur when the virus has abated a bit, giving the person just enough energy that viral anxiety kicks up to throw them into a flurry. With Candida, it's frequently EBV and resulting liver dysfunction causing gut trouble, not this beneficial fungus, nor any parasites, or the misunderstood leaky gut. For the explanation of true, not viral-caused ADHD, what's really going on with Candida and digestive health, and more insight into depression, see the chapters devoted to them in Medical Medium. And with depersonalization, what shows on the surface of these young people is despondency, detachment, and thoughtlessness. What's so often going on beneath the surface is that EBV's neurotoxins are short-circuiting neurological communications, interfering with a brain that's still trying to develop. Because the brain isn't fully developed until well into a person's 20s, this result of stage 4 EBV is a widespread issue, making so many young people feel beyond isolated and their loved ones feel powerless to help. It's one of the disasters occurring in today's world and entirely avoidable if the word about EBV gets out there. No matter your age, if you're already dealing with one of these issues or with mystery illnesses such as fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, rheumatoid arthritis, RA, tinnitus, vertigo, Meniere's disease, pulmonary fibrosis, cystic fibrosis, interstitial lung disease, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, other connective tissue disorders, sarcoidosis, restless leg syndrome, or multiple sclerosis, MS, then you are already an expert on the disruption stage 4 EBV can cause in life, both physical and emotional. Stage 4 EBV is often the one that results the most in sufferers feeling or being told they are crazy, lazy, liars, and/or delusional. Blood tests, x-rays, MRIs, and CT scans can't diagnose it, which leaves doctors massively confused about the droves of patients visiting them with mystery neurological symptoms. Family members and friends too may have a difficult time validating someone who can't offer a medical explanation about why she or he is unable to perform her or his normal functions. This is often the time when EBV sufferers feel most alone, knowing deep down that they would never make up the aches and pains, brain fog, dizziness, extreme fatigue and more, and yet left to wonder if maybe they're deluding themselves, and they truly are making up their illness or causing it in some way. Well, wonder no more. There is a very real physical explanation for all of it. At stage 4 of EBV, viral neurotoxins flood the body's bloodstream and travel to the brain, where they short out neurotransmitters. Plus the virus inflames or goes after the nerves throughout the body, making them sensitive and even allergic to the neurotoxins. As a result, it's common to experience heavier brain fog, memory loss, confusion, depression, anxiety, migraines, joint pain, nerve pain, heart palpitations, eye floaters, restless legs, ringing in the ears, insomnia, difficulty healing from injuries, and more. When you get to Chapter 5, you'll discover the particulars of these symptoms and conditions. When nerves are injured, whether from an accident or by EBV, they send an alarm hormone to notify your body that the nerves are exposed and need repair.